This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This country and others have inventive genius that we have not fully harnessed yet for climate. And that's the step we got to take. You know, if we get that genius working at a good enough pace, we will solve climate change. And people will look back on it just like they do with stratospheric ozone and say, hey, I didn't even notice. You know, it's like my refrigerator still works, my air conditioner door. I didn't even notice we got rid of CFCs.
Remember the 70s? Remember feathered hair, pull tab soda cans, debates about the thinning ozone layer? Our guest this week on Sea Change Radio is Durwood Zelke, a policy advocate and environmental crusader who started working 4 decades ago to advance policy that would help preserve the ozone layer. Zelke is the founder and president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, based in Washington, D.C. and Geneva. He's a noted international environmental lawyer who received both an Ozone Protection Award and a Climate Protection Award in 2008 for his help in maximizing the climate benefits of the Montreal Protocol. Now, thanks largely to Zelke and his organization, debates about the ozone layer are nearly as anachronistic as pull-tab cans and feathered hair. Nearly. Zelke is still working on ozone protection, and in line with the times, his organization's mission has broadened to include combating climate change. Stay tuned as we discuss in detail how the Montreal Protocol succeeded in making inroads to protect the ozone from hydrofluorocarbon pollutants, where the Kyoto Protocol has fallen short, and what needs to happen to make the next international climate change negotiations more productive. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Durwood Zelke. He is the founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Durwood, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, maybe you can give us a little thumbnail sketch of what the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development is all about.
The first thing that we focus on is climate change. That's overwhelmingly our focus today. And it requires that we improve our governance ability around the world. Governance can include international treaties. We need them when we can get them. It includes regional agreements, which we need when we can get those, and bottom-up efforts at the national level, down to the city level. I mean, mayors and governors are among the most important people in fighting any environmental problem, including climate change. And then there are voluntary measures as well. There are consumer boycotts that have worked remarkably well on certain environmental problems, including protecting the stratospheric ozone layer, and I'll get back to that as we go on. I do one other thing as well within this package of activities, and that's to focus on compliance and enforcement with all laws. So if you have a treaty, it doesn't mean anything unless it's implemented and unless you can get the people it addresses to follow its rules. So compliance enforcement is another piece, and I direct a network called the International Network for Environmental Compliance and Enforcement, about 4,000 government officials around the world, 150 countries, who struggle to improve compliance with all environmental laws.
So the Montreal Protocol, which I want you to explain what it is, it's widely considered one of the world's most successful multilateral environmental agreements, Durwood. You helped lead those efforts. Why has it been so roundly lauded as being successful?
We started back in California and other places in the United States in the 70s and said, we just figured out because of two brilliant scientists at the University of California, Irvine, Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland, that CFCs, which were used as propellants in our hairspray and our underarm deodorant sprays, were destroying the stratospheric ozone layer. And we said, well, we should go a little further than just boycotting these aerosols in these spray cans, and we should push our governments to do more to ban these chemicals that we now know are dangerous. Then we went a little further and said, you know, we need the whole world to do this if we're going to protect a global resource like the stratospheric ozone layer. And that means we need a treaty. So we pushed hard to get the Montreal Protocol as a global treaty. And in 1987, we succeeded in doing that. And since that time, the treaty has become the best environmental treaty the world has ever developed. It has phased out about 100 ozone-damaging chemicals that also are very strong in providing global warming, producing global warming, these same chemicals. And we can measure in the atmosphere that we phased out these chemicals by almost 100%, about 98% so far. And this has put the stratospheric ozone layer on the way to recovery. And it's also produced tremendous climate protection. In fact, if you look at the entire package of things that we've done, starting with the consumer boycotts, national measures, and the treaty, we've already solved an amount of climate change that would be equal today to the contribution of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. And I think most of us know that's the single biggest piece, representing about 55% of the entire global problem. So it's pretty encouraging to think that we created a treaty that actually has done this brilliant job, meant primarily to solve the problem of stratospheric ozone, but also as a side benefit, solving a part of climate that is, depends on how you measure it, it's 5 to 10, maybe even 20 times more in climate protection than the Kyoto Protocol. Every country of the world is a party. That's the big ones, the small ones, the rich ones, the poor ones. Every country of the world has complied, and every country of the world thinks this is a fair treaty. This is really important because climate protection at the global level and at the U.S. level is about equity as well as technology and economics and so on. And we must make sure that we create governance approaches that are fair and equitable. The Montreal Protocol has done this by providing a grace period for developing countries. They get anywhere from 5 to 10, sometimes closer to 20 years before they have to start their control measures to phase down these damaging chemicals. The Montreal Protocol also provides a dedicated funding mechanism called the Multilateral Fund that pays with donor money from the rich countries to the poorer countries for making the transition to safer alternatives in our refrigerators, in our air conditioning, in the insulating foams that we use these chemicals to blow.
And was this also auto manufacturers' air conditioning systems that they had to make long-term adjustments to?
Absolutely. So mobile air conditioning is a key part. It's anywhere from 25 to 50% of the total problem, depending on how you measure it. And the automobile companies did a very good job making a fast transition. And the Montreal Protocol has worked in sequence. We refer to it as a treaty that's a start and strengthen treaty. We start with what we can. And then we learn by doing, by applying the measures to phase out what we can. And then we, for the 25 years, a little more that we've been in operation, we've gotten more and more confident, and we've strengthened the treaty further to do more and more. So the mobile air conditioning folks moved very fast to move out of the CFCs. They moved into a chemical called HCFCs, and they moved from there to HFCs. And the HFCs now are the ones we are targeting to get rid of, those with a high global warming potential.
So this sounds great. This would be a terrific template to work from to try to get other multilateral environmental agreements in place. You said that it was something widely accepted, everybody agreed upon, and all these governments are pleased with it.
Yes.
Now, take us to Kyoto protocols and subsequent other multilateral negotiations that seem to be ongoing and makes the casual observer like myself want to pull their hair out. Right. Why can't we all just use the Montreal Protocol as a template? What
well,
sets it apart?
Believe me, I've been asked that same question by a lot of smart folks. And let me first say that we can do more with the Montreal Protocol. It is not done with its job. In fact, there is an effort underway right now to strengthen the treaty further to phase out one of the super greenhouse gases called hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, used as refrigerants in our refrigerators, in our cars, in our air conditioning, and in the insulating foams, and to move to safer substitutes that are more energy efficient as well. Because when you run a refrigerator or you run your air conditioner, your climate footprint includes the power plant that generates the electricity to run the thing, and that's the biggest single part of the climate damage.
What's the difference between HCFCs and HFCs, just to clarify here?
Yeah, okay. So the treaty, as I said, is a start and strengthen treaty, and we moved from the very damaging CFCs that were bad for destroying ozone and bad for causing climate change to an intermediate set of chemicals called HCFCs. We always knew these were transitional chemicals, but we could move into them quickly to cut our problem way down, both on ozone protection and on climate protection. However, the HCFCs still destroy the ozone layer, just not quite as much. They still cause climate change, not quite as much. So we accelerated the phase out of those chemicals back in 2007 explicitly for climate protection. But what's happened since then is that the substitute that some chemical companies are putting on the market are called HFCs. Now, these do not damage the stratospheric ozone layer. No effect on the stratospheric ozone layer. However, they're super greenhouse gases. So if you were looking at the Montreal Protocol in the simplest way, you'd say, this treaty has done its job to protect the ozone layer. But if you're concerned with the broader problem of climate change as well, you'd say, we're not done. We have to make sure we get out of, better yet, avoid going into the HFCs. That's where we are right now. The island countries led by the Federated States of Micronesia said several years ago, 2009, what can we do for fast climate mitigation? Because we are seeing sea level rise already. We are seeing storm surges that are washing away our outer atolls. We need action now, and we are not confident that the UN climate negotiations will move fast enough for us to save our islands. They were joined by other islands, and then ultimately by the US, Canada, and Mexico, and now there are more than 100 countries, north and south, big and small, saying, let's do the amendment to the Montreal Protocol to phase down the HFCs for climate protection. This is something that we are inadvertently pushing companies towards. We should stop right now. And we have good substitutes for almost all sectors already. And many countries and companies are doing what you'd call a leapfrog strategy. They're phasing out the current chemical, the HCFCs, and they're saying, you know, let's look at the HFCs. Everybody tells us they're bad, and when we do look at them, we agree. We will jump over them into the safer substitutes. That's what's happening with the smart players. Not everybody's as smart or as capable as the top runners, and so we still have work to do to get the rest of the world to say yes. But we're very, very close to getting this treaty strengthened further.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. On the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned out basement.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Derwood Zelke. He's a policy advocate and the founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, based in Washington, D.C. Just to give our listeners a more specific idea of the impact of the Montreal Protocol, it says here on your website, the Montreal Protocol will have done more to mitigate climate change than the initial Kyoto Protocol reduction target, reducing emissions in terms of carbon dioxide equivalent by 135 billion tons between 1990 and 2010, and delayed climate impacts by about up to 12 years. And then, as you mentioned, if you can get these HFCs to be banned, we could avoid at least 100 more billion tons of CO2 equivalent by 2050.
Right.
What does that mean compared to when we look at exhaust and other, not only from transportation industry, but also pollution and particulate matter from coal plants and other more well-known pollutants?
Well, the 200 billion tons of CO2 equivalent that we could avoid would come if we move very fast to get out of the HFCs, really before we even get into them in a serious way. That means moving by 2020. That's the year that the UN climate treaty is supposed to come into effect and start the regulation of, in a more serious way, of carbon dioxide. So that number of 200 billion tons can be translated into temperature. So that's easier to understand in some ways. And it can avoid 0.5 degrees, a half a degree Celsius of warming. Now, that's a lot when you look at the goal of trying to stay below an increase from pre-industrial times of 2 degrees Celsius. So when you put this over the global average, this is a lot of new energy entering the atmosphere, causing us climate change. So we can avoid half a degree Celsius. We can avoid the 200 billion tons. Doing the HFC phase down right now is a way of building political momentum. We have the technology. We have the best treaty in the world. We have more than 100 countries saying this is a good thing to do. If we do this, we reinvigorate the whole process of multilateralism. So you go over to the Kyoto Protocol and the UN climate negotiations. They've struggled, and we have to help them by saying, here are some things outside of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change over here that we can do right now. We have the experience of more than 25 years. We can do them very fast, and speed matters. The more we can take out of the system in terms of future climate warming today, the easier it will be to have a safe climate in the future. It's still a tight race, and of course, CO2 is the dominant pollutant. It's 55%. We have to succeed with the CO2 side from fossil fuel by moving to clean energy as fast as we can. But we'll lose if we don't do HFCs and this broader category called short-lived climate pollutants. And I'll mention that the short-lived climate pollutants include the black carbon, soot, includes tropospheric ozone or photochemical smog, and it includes methane, as well as the HFCs. And if you take that part, the short-lived pollutants, out of the system, you get an almost immediate response in terms of reduced warming, and you can cut the rate of climate change globally in half. And think about that. We can cut the rate of climate change in half, and we can do it using national air pollution rules, like China is beginning to do right now. Beijing and other polluted cities in China are saying, we're going to clean up our air because we know globally that this air pollution is killing more than 7 million people a year. And so this is a good thing to do, independent of whether you're concerned about climate change. We want to protect our citizens. We want to protect our workforce. And if you take care of the tropospheric ozone, also from national laws that you implement and enforce, you can improve your health and you can improve your crop yields significantly. So there are many reasons for doing the short-lived climate pollutants. independent of climate, and some countries are still struggling with whether they want to make serious commitments on the climate side, but they do say and they do show they'll make serious commitments for public health of their own citizens. So that whole package of short-lived climate pollutants is extremely important. They will be featured at the UN Secretary General's Climate Summit next week in New York. And there is a dedicated group called the Climate and Clean Air Coalition to reduce short-lived climate pollutants, started by the U.S., Sweden, a broad group of countries, including the United Nations Environment Program. It's now grown to about 90-plus partners. And that's a rock and roll group. This group meets regularly. We'll be meeting in New York the day before the Secretary General Summit next week. And this group is all about action. What can we do today? It's a group that is dedicated to the concept of a sense of urgent optimism. We are optimists, but we know that climate protection is a matter of urgency. But we can run this first leg of the race, and we can deliver tremendous benefits while we also take CO2 measures as fast as we possibly can.
And can you give us a summary of where things stand with these United Nations framework conventions on climate change? The Kyoto Protocol expired a couple of years ago, correct?
The Kyoto Protocol did expire, but it was continued by European countries. It's a small part of the world. It's about 12% of global emissions are covered in the extended Kyoto Protocol. It's not enough to save the world, of course, from climate impacts.
So is there something after the Kyoto Protocol that we can look forward to hearing negotiations about, or is it about trying to get more of these nations to ratify the Kyoto Protocol? I know that the U.S. never signed on to it, and Canada actually withdrew a few years ago.
That's right. No, I think the better strategy is to focus on the negotiations going on under the UN climate treaty right now for a new treaty that will supersede Kyoto. And this treaty is expected to be concluded in Paris next year at the 21st meeting of the parties. So it's 21 years of negotiations.
Look at the tears roll down the street. The sky's crying. Look at the tears roll down the street. I'm waiting until looking for my baby. I wonder where can she be?
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Durwood Zelke. He's the founder of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. What are the biggest barriers to success on these multilateral treaties? Is it the governments or the companies that have more leverage within these governments that would be potentially signing on to a treaty? In your opinion, being somebody who's had real experience and inside knowledge of the whole machinations of this negotiation process.
Well, you know, it's a very complicated system, but it includes what consumers do. What do we demand in our life when we buy a car? When do we pay attention to the refrigerant? Well, we should in our mobile air conditioning. When we buy a refrigerator, when we buy any other product that has a climate impact, we should pay attention. We should demand the very best from industry and start making the markets that industry responds to. We should be working with our national governments and making sure that they do the strongest environmental protection possible. California's done an exemplary climate Protection Program, and they're setting an example for the world. Very important that they continue to succeed. And then at the national level, we want the same thing. And President Obama's climate action plan is quite good, given the nature of the Congress that he has to deal with. We will not get the economy-wide legislation, but he will use and continue to use his executive authority to get some big pieces of the climate problem solved. That's very good. Then you have to go to the question of, how do you level the playing field around the world? So the U.S. starts doing its climate protection, and Europe does it, and then they look around and say, we can't solve the problem without China, without India, without the other big players. And we also don't want them to be a pollution haven for climate pollutants and have cheap manufacturing that undercuts our companies at home. So you want to try to keep the playing field level. But it's hard for any country, including the U.S., to unilaterally go to China and say, we want you guys to do this. China is a big, powerful country, and China's got to find its own internal motivation. The U.S. can help enlighten China's self-interest or India's self-interest. The U.S. can help provide some technical expertise, some funding on the best energy and environmental technologies. But again, the citizens and the sovereigns of India, China, Indonesia, other South Africa, Brazil, they need to come to their own conclusions. And they're doing it. I think maybe we asked, or we were perceived as having asked too much, too fast, and companies and countries were nervous. They didn't know how to deliver on some of those demands that we want for climate. The demands are legitimate. I mean, we're in serious problem. We're in a deep problem with climate change. It's very serious. Impacts are coming already. But if you tell people that they have to make radical changes, they get their back up and they sometimes slow down. So Montreal Protocol didn't do that. It said, we know there's a crisis, but we'll start a little more modestly. And we started with a control measure that said, we will phase out half of this group of CFCs in 12 years. And then we ratified and met, and the parties came together and said, you know, this is pretty easy. Let's do 75%. And then they've met every year since. And the next year they met and said, you know, it's even easier than we thought last year. Let's do 100% and we'll do it in 10 years instead of 12. So we started, we learned, we got confident, and we strengthened our control measures. And it turned out to be a really brilliant approach. And it's not that we didn't understand this when we were doing climate. We did. We tried to build some of these things into the Kyoto Protocol, but we didn't succeed in the same way we did with Montreal. So we have to go back to the drawing boards, and we have to. I think the key, one of the key things I'll repeat is that, you know, climate is not one monolithic problem. It's a package of problems, and where you can reach into that package and pull out the HFCs that go with refrigeration and air conditioning and solve it in the Montreal Protocol, you absolutely should do that. When you can reach in and pull out black carbon soot and tropospheric ozone and solve that part through national air pollution controls, you absolutely have to do that. Now, you need to strengthen those national controls. You need to amend the Montreal Protocol. It's not as though there isn't further work to do. But those venues already exist. Those institutional structures are already there. People know how to do their job. Give them that job, and they will do it. And then we'll have a smaller package for the UN to deal with to solve, still gigantic, but smaller, on energy and CO2.
Durwood Zelke, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ruben Wilson, Neil Young, and Elmore James.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.